the loss of sexual function, and the fact that all the drugs that are currently available are somewhat sedative. You're not seriously thinking of taking any of these, are you? Well, I've taken Haldol in the past, and Thorazine. And? Really horrible. I was totally zombified. It felt like my brain was full of Elmer's glue.
Isn't there anything else?
Valium, Librium, Xanax.
Mama takes those, Xanax and Valium.
Yeah, that would make sense. He makes a face and sets the physician's desk reference aside and says, "Move over." We adjust our positions on the couch until we are lying side by side. It's very cozy.
Don't take anything.
Why not?
You're not sick.
Henry laughs. That's what I love you for, your inability to perceive all my hideous flaws.
He's unbuttoning my shirt, and I wrap my hand around his. He looks at me, waiting. I am a little angry.
I don't understand why you talk like that. You're always saying horrible things about yourself. You aren't like that. You're good.
Henry looks at my hand and disengages his and draws me closer.
I'm not good, he says softly in my ear. But maybe I will be.
Hmm?
You better be. I'm good to you.
Too true.
Claire?
Hmm?
Do you ever lie awake wondering if I'm some kind of joke God is playing on you?
No. I lie awake worrying that you might disappear and never come back.
I lie awake brooding about some of the stuff I sort of half know about in the future, but I have total faith in the idea that we are supposed to be together. Total faith.
Don't you?
Henry kisses me. Nor time, nor place, nor chance, nor death can bow my least desires unto the least remove.
Come again?
I don't mind if I do.
Braggart.
Now who's saying horrible things about me?
Monday, September 6th, 1993. Henry is 30. I'm sitting on the stoop of a dingy white aluminum-sided house in Humboldt Park. It's Monday morning around 10. I'm waiting for Ben to get back from wherever he is. I don't like this neighborhood very much. I feel kind of exposed sitting here at Ben's door, but he's an extremely punctual guy, so I continue to wait with confidence. I watch two young Hispanic women push baby strollers along the pitched and broken sidewalk. As I meditate on the inequity of city services, I hear someone yell, "Library boy!" in the distance. I look in the direction of the voice, and sure enough, it's Gomez. I groan inwardly. Gomez has an amazing talent for running into me when I'm up to something particularly nefarious. I will have to get rid of him before Ben shows up. Gomez comes sailing toward me happily. He's wearing his lawyer outfit and carrying his briefcase. I sigh. Ça va, comrade? Ça va. What are you doing here? Good question. Waiting on a friend. What time is it? 10:15? September 6th, 1993, he adds helpfully. I know, Gomez, but thanks anyway. You visiting a client? Yeah, 10-year-old girl. Mom's boyfriend made her drink Drano. I do get tired of humans. Yeah, too many maniacs, not enough Michelangelos. You had lunch? Or breakfast, I guess it would be? Yeah, I kinda need to stay here, wait for my friend. I didn't know any of your friends lived out this way. All the people I know over here are sadly in need of legal counsel. Friend from library school. And here he is. Ben drives up in his 62 silver Mercedes. The inside is a wreck, but from the outside it's a sweet-looking car. Gomez whistles softly. Sorry I'm late, Ben says, hurrying up the walk. House call. Gomez looks at me inquisitively. I ignore him. Ben looks at Gomez and at me. Gomez, Ben, Ben, Gomez. So sorry you have to leave, comrade. Actually, I've got a couple hours free. Ben takes the situation in hand. Gomez, great meeting you. Some other time, yes? Ben is quite nearsighted, and he peers kindly at Gomez through his thick glasses that magnify his eyes to twice their normal size. Ben's jingling his keys in his hand. It's making me nervous. We both stand quietly, waiting for Gomez to leave.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, bye, says Gomez. I'll call you this afternoon, I tell him. He turns without looking at me and walks away. I feel bad, but there are things I don't want Gomez to know, and this is one of them. Ben and I turn to each other, share a look that acknowledges the fact that we know things about each other that are problematic. He opens his front door. I have always itched to try my hand at breaking into Ben's place because he has a large number and variety of locks and security devices. We enter the dark, narrow hall. It always smells like cabbage in here, even though I know for a fact that Ben never cooks much in the way of food, let alone cabbage. We walk to the back stairway, up and into another hallway, through one bedroom and into another, which Ben has set up as a lab. He sets down his bag and hangs up his jacket. I half expect him to put on some tennis shoes, a la Mr. Rogers, but instead he putters around with his coffee maker. I sit down on a folding chair and wait for Ben to finish. More than anyone else I know, Ben looks like a librarian. And I did, in fact, meet him at Rosary, but he quit before finishing his MLS. He has gotten thinner since I saw him last and lost a little more hair. Ben has AIDS, and every time I see him I pay attention because I never know how it will go with him. You're looking good, I tell him. Massive doses of AZT, and vitamins and yoga and visual imaging. Speaking of which, what can I do for you? I'm getting married. Ben is surprised and then delighted. Congratulations! To whom? Claire. You met her. The girl with the very long red hair.
Oh, yes.
Ben looks grave.
She knows?
Yes.
Well, great.
He gives me a look that says that this is all very nice, but what of it? So her parents have planned this huge wedding up in Michigan. Church, bridesmaids, rice, the whole nine yards, and a lavish reception at the yacht club afterward. White tie, no less. Ben pours out coffee and hands me a mug with Winnie the Pooh on it. I stir powdered creamer into it. It's cold up here, and the coffee smells bitter, but kind of good. I need to be there. I need to get through about 8 hours of huge, mind-boggling stress without disappearing.
Ah.
Ben has a way of taking in a problem, just accepting it, which I find very soothing. I need something that's going to KO every dopamine receptor I've got. Nevane, Haldol, Thorazine, Sorrentol, Melaril, Stelazine. Ben polishes his glasses on his sweater. He looks like a large, hairless mouse without them. I was hoping you could make this for me. I fish around in my jeans for the paper, find it, and hand it over. Ben squints at it, reads.
3-2-4-96 fluoro, 1-2... Benzosoxazole, 3YL, colloidal silicon dioxide, hydroxypropyl methylcellulose, propylene glycol.
He looks up at me, bewildered.
What is this?
It's a new antipsychotic called risperidone, marketed as Risperdal. It'll be commercially available in 1998, but I'd like to try it now. It belongs to a new class of drugs called benzosoxazole derivatives.
Where did you get this?
PDR, the 2000 edition.
Who makes it?
Janssen.
Henry, you know you don't tolerate antipsychotics very well, unless this works in some radically different way.
They don't know how it works. Selective, monoaminergic antagonist with high affinity for serotonin type 2, dopamine type 2, blah, blah, blah.
Well, same old, same old. What makes you think this is going to be any better than Haldol?
I smile patiently. It's an educated guess. I don't know for sure. Can you make that? Ben hesitates.
I can, yes.
How soon? Takes a while to build up in the system.
I'll let you know. When's the wedding?
October 23rd.
What's the dosage?
Start with 1 milligram and build from there. Ben stands up, stretches. In the dim light of this cold room, he seems old, jaundiced, paper-skinned. Part of Ben likes the challenge. Hey, let's replicate this avant-garde drug that nobody's even invented yet. And part of him doesn't like the risk.
Henry, you don't even know for sure that dopamine's your problem.
Well, you've seen the scans.
Yeah. Why not just live with it? The cure might be worse than the problem.
Ben, what if I snap my fingers right now?
I stand up, lean close to him, snap my fingers.
And right now, you suddenly found yourself standing in Alan's bedroom in 1986.
I'd kill the fucker.
But you can't, because you didn't.
Ben closes his eyes, shakes his head.
And you can't change anything. He will still get sick, you will still get sick, und so weiter. What if you had to watch him die over and over?
Ben sits in the folding chair. He's not looking at me.
That's what it's like, Ben. I mean, yeah, sometimes it's fun, but mostly it's getting lost and stealing and trying to just...
cope. Ben sighs. God, I don't know why I put up with you.
Novelty? My boyish good looks? Dream on.
Hey, am I invited to this wedding?
I am startled.
It never occurred to me that Ben would want to come.
Yeah! Really? You would come?
Beats funerals.
Great! My side of the church is filling up rapidly. You'll be my 8th guest.
Ben laughs. Invite all your ex-girlfriends, that'll swell the ranks.
I'd never survive it. Most of them want my head on a stick.
Ben gets up and rummages in one of his desk drawers. He pulls out an empty pill bottle and opens another drawer, takes out a huge bottle of capsules, opens it, and places 3 pills in the small bottle. He tosses it to me.
What is it?
I ask, opening the bottle and shaking a pill onto my palm.
It's an endorphin stabilizer combined with an antidepressant.
It's... hey, don't.
I have popped the pill into my mouth and swallowed.
It's morphine-based.
Ben sighs.
You have the most casually arrogant attitude towards drugs.
I like opiates.
I bet. Don't think I'm going to let you have a ton of those either. Let me know if you think they would do the job for the wedding.
In case this other thing doesn't pan out, they last about 4 hours, so you would need 2.
Ben nods at the 2 remaining pills.
Don't gobble those up just for fun, okay? Scout's honor.
Ben snorts. I pay him for the pills and leave. As I walk downstairs, I feel the rush grab me and I stop at the bottom of the stairs to luxuriate in it. It's been a while. Whatever Ben has mixed in here, it's fantastic. It's like an orgasm times 10 plus cocaine, and it seems to be getting stronger.
As I walk out the front door, I practically trip over Gomez. He's been waiting for me. Care for a ride?
Sure.
I am deeply moved by his concern, or his curiosity, or whatever. We walk to his car, a Chevy Nova with 2 bashed headlights. I climb into the passenger seat. Gomez gets in and slams his door. He coaxes the little car into starting, and we set off. The city is gray and dingy, and it's starting to rain. Fat drops smack the windshield as crack houses and empty lots flow by us. Gomez turns on NPR, and they're playing Charles Mingus, who sounds a little slow to me, but then again, why not? It's a free country. Ashland Avenue is full of brain-jarring potholes, but otherwise things are fine. Quite fine, actually. My head is fluid and mobile, like liquid mercury escaped from a broken thermometer. And it's all I can do to keep myself from moaning with pleasure as the drug laps all my nerve endings with its tiny chemical tongues.
We pass ESP, Psychic Card Reader, Pedro's Tire Outlet, Burger King, Pizza Hut, and I Am a Passenger runs through my head, weaving its way into the Mingus. Gomez says something which I don't catch, and then again,
Henry!
Yes?
What are you on?
I'm not quite sure. Science experiment of sorts.
Why?
Stellar question. I'll get back to you on that. We don't say anything else until the car stops in front of Claire and Charisse's apartment. I look at Gomez in confusion.
You need company,
he tells me gently. I don't disagree. Gomez lets us in the front door and we walk upstairs. Claire opens the door and when she sees me, she looks upset, relieved, and amused, all at once.
I have talked Henry into getting into my bed, and Gomez and I are sitting in the living room drinking tea and eating peanut butter and kiwi jelly sandwiches.
Learn to cook, woman, intones Gomez.
He sounds like Charlton Heston handing down the Ten Commandments. One of these days. I stir sugar into my tea. Thank you for going and getting him.
Anything for you, kitten.
He starts to roll a cigarette. Gomez is the only person I know who smokes during a meal. I refrain from commenting. He lights up. He looks at me and I brace myself.
So, what was that little episode all about, huh? Most of the people who go to Compassionate Pharmacopeia are AIDS victims or cancer patients.
You know Ben? I don't know why I'm surprised. Gomez knows everybody.
I know of Ben. My mom used to go to Ben when she was having chemo.
Oh. I review the situation, searching for things I can safely mention.
Whatever Ben gave him really put him in the slow zone.
We're trying to find something that will help Henry stay in the present.
He seems a little too inanimate for daily use.
Yeah. Maybe a lower dosage?
Why are you doing this?
Doing what?
Aiding and abetting Mr. Mayhem, marrying him, no less.
Henry calls my name. I get up. Gomez reaches out and grabs my hand.
Claire, please.
Gomez, let go. I stare him down. After a long, awful moment, he drops his eyes and lets me go. I hurry down the hall into my room and shut the door. Henry is stretched out like a cat, diagonally across the bed, face down. I take off my shoes and stretch out beside him. How's it going? I ask him. Henry rolls over and smiles.
Heaven.
He strokes my face.
Care to join me?
No. Henry sighs.
You are so good. I shouldn't be trying to corrupt you.
I'm not good. I'm afraid. We lie together in silence for a long time. The sun is shining now, and it shows me my bedroom in early afternoon. The curve of the walnut bed frame, the gold and violet oriental rug, the hairbrush and lipstick and bottle of hand lotion on the bureau. A copy of Art in America with Leon Golub on the cover lies on the seat of my old garage sale armchair, partially obscured by Au Rebours. Henry is wearing black socks. His long, bony feet hang off the edge of the bed. He seems thin to me. Henry's eyes are closed. Perhaps he can feel me staring at him because he opens his eyes and smiles at me. His hair is falling into his face and I brush it back. Henry takes my hand and kisses the palm. I unbutton his jeans and slide my hand over his cock, but Henry shakes his head and takes my hand and holds it. Sorry, Claire, he says softly. There's something in this stuff that seems to have short-circuited the equipment. Later, maybe. That'll be fun on our wedding night. Henry shakes his head.
I can't take this for the wedding. It's too much fun. I mean, Ben's a genius, but he's used to working with people who are terminally ill. Whatever he's got in here, it plays like a near-death experience.
He sighs and sets the pill bottle on my nightstand.
I should mail those to Ingrid. This is her perfect drug.
I hear the front door open and then it slams shut. Gomez, leaving. You want something to eat? I ask.
No, thanks.
Is Ben going to make that other drug for you?
He's going to try, Henry says.
What if it's not right?
You mean if Ben fucks up?
Yeah. Henry says,
Whatever happens, we both know that I live to be at least 43, so don't worry about it.
43? What happens after 43?
I don't know, Claire. Maybe I figure out how to stay in the present.
He gathers me in and we are quiet. When I wake up later, it is dark and Henry is sleeping beside me. The little bottle of pills shines red in the light of the LED display of the alarm clock. 43? Monday, September 27th, 1993. Claire is 22. Henry is 30. I let myself into Henry's apartment and turn on the lights. We're going to the opera tonight. It's the Ghosts of Versailles. The Lyric Opera won't seat latecomers, so I'm flustered, and at first I don't realize that no lights means Henry isn't here. Then I do realize it, and I'm annoyed because he's going to make us late. Then I wonder if he's gone. Then I hear someone breathing. I stand still. The breathing is coming from the kitchen. I run into the kitchen and turn on the light, and Henry is lying on the floor, fully clothed, in a strange, rigid pose, staring straight ahead. As I stand there, he makes a low sound, not like a human sound, a groan that clatters in his throat, that tears through his clenched teeth. Oh, God! Oh, God! I call 911. The operator assures me they'll be here in minutes. And as I sit on the kitchen floor, staring at Henry, I feel a wave of anger, and I find Henry's Rolodex in his desk, and I dial the number. Hello? The voice is tiny and distant.
Is this Ben Madison?
Yes, who is this?
Claire Abshire. Listen, Ben, Henry is lying on the floor, totally rigid, and can't talk. What the fuck?
What?
Shit, call 911.
I did.
The drug is mimicking Parkinson's. He needs dopamine. Tell them. Oh, shit, call me from the hospital.
They're here.
Okay, call me.
I hang up and face the paramedics. Later, after the ambulance ride to Mercy Hospital, after Henry has been admitted, injected, and intubated, and is lying in a hospital bed attached to a monitor, relaxed and sleeping, I look up and see a tall, gaunt man in the doorway of Henry's room, and I remember that I have forgotten to call Ben. He walks in and stands across from me on the other side of the bed. The room is dark, and the light from the hallway silhouettes Ben as he bows his head and says, I'm so sorry. So sorry. I reach across the bed, take his hands. It's okay. He's going to be fine, really. Ben shakes his head. It's completely my fault. I should never have made it for him.
What happened? Ben sighs and sits down in the chair. I sit on the bed.
It could be several things, he says. It could be just a side effect. Could happen to anybody. But it could be that Henry didn't have the recipe quite right. I mean, it's a lot to memorize, and I couldn't check it.
We are both silent. Henry's monitor drips fluid into his arm. An orderly walks by with a cart. Finally, I say, Ben?
Yes, Claire.
Do something for me.
Anything.
Cut him off. No more drugs. Drugs aren't going to work.
Ben grins at me, relieved. Just say no.
Exactly. We laugh. Ben sits with me for a while. When he gets up to leave, he takes my hand and says, Thank you for being kind about it. He could easily have died. But he didn't.
No, he didn't.
See you at the wedding?
Yes.
We are standing in the hall. In the glaring, fluorescent light, Ben looks tired and ill. He ducks his head and turns and walks down the hall. And I turn back to the dim room where Henry lies sleeping.
Turning Point. Friday, October 22nd, 1993. Henry is 30. I am strolling down Linden Street in South Haven, at large for an hour while Claire and her mother do something at the florist's. The wedding is tomorrow. But as the groom, I don't seem to have too many responsibilities. Be there. That's the main item on my to-do list. Claire is constantly being whisked away to fittings, consultations, bridal showers. When I do see her, she always looks rather wistful. It's a clear, cold day, and I dawdle. I wish South Haven had a decent bookstore.
Even the library consists mainly of Barbara Cartland and John Grisham. I have the Penguin edition of Kleist with me, but I'm not in the mood. I pass an antique shop, a bakery, a bank, another antique shop. As I walk by the barber's shop, I peer in. There's an old man being shaved by a dapper little balding barber, and I know at once what I'm gonna do. Little bells clang against the door as I walk into the shop. It smells of soap, steam, hair lotion, and elderly flesh. Everything is pale green. The chair is old and ornate with chrome, and there are elaborate bottles lining dark wooden shelves and trays of scissors, combs, and razors. It's almost medical. It's very Norman Rockwell. The barber glances up at me. "Haircut?" I ask. He nods at the row of empty straight-back chairs with magazines neatly stacked on a rack at one end of the row. Sinatra is playing on the radio. I sit down and leaf through a copy of Reader's Digest. The barber wipes traces of lather from the old man's chin and applies aftershave. The old man climbs gingerly from the chair and pays up. The barber helps him into his coat and hands him his cane.
"See ya, George," says the old man as he creeps out.
"Bye, Ed,"
replies the barber. He turns his attention to me.
"What'll it be?"
I hop into the chair and he steps me up a few inches and swivels me around to face the mirror. I take a long last look at my hair. I hold my thumb and forefinger about an inch apart. "Cut it all off." He nods his approval and ties a plastic cape around my neck. Soon his scissors are flashing little metal-on-metal noises around my head, and my hair is falling to the floor. When he is done, he brushes me off and removes the cape, and voila! I've become the me of my future. Get me to the church on time. Saturday, October 23rd, 1993. Henry is 30. Claire is 22. I wake up at 6 a.m. and it's raining. I am in a snug little green room under the eaves in a cozy little bed and breakfast called Blake's, which is right on the South Beach in South Haven. Claire's parents have chosen this place. My dad is sleeping in an equally cozy pink room downstairs, next to Mrs. Kim in a lovely yellow room. Grandpa and Grams are in the uber-cozy blue master bedroom. I lie in the extra-soft bed under Laura Ashley's sheets, and I can hear the wind flinging itself against the house. The rain is pouring down in sheets. I wonder if I can run in this monsoon. I hear it coursing through the gutters and drumming on the roof, which is about 2 feet above my face. This room is like a garret. It has a delicate little writing desk in case I need to pen any ladylike missives on my wedding day. There's a china ewer and basin on the bureau. If I actually wanted to use them, I'd probably have to break the ice in the water first, 'cause it's quite cold up here. I feel like a pink worm in the core of this green room, as though I've eaten my way in and should be working on becoming a butterfly or something. I'm not real awake here at the moment. I hear somebody coughing. I hear my heart beating and the high-pitched sound, which is my nervous system doing its thing. Oh, God, let today be a normal day. Let me be normally befuddled, normally nervous. Get me to the church on time, in time. Let me not startle anyone, especially myself. Let me get through our wedding day as best I can with no special effects. Deliver Claire from unpleasant scenes. Amen.
7 a.m. I wake up in my bed, the bed of my childhood. As I float on the surface of waking, I can't find myself in time. Is it Christmas? Thanksgiving? Is it third grade again? Am I sick? Why is it raining? Outside the yellow curtains, the sky is dead, and the big elm tree is being stripped of its yellow leaves by the wind. I have been dreaming all night. The dreams merge now. In one part of this dream, I was swimming in the ocean. I was a mermaid. I was sort of new at being a mermaid, and one of the other mermaids was trying to teach me. She was giving me mermaid lessons. I was afraid to breathe underwater. The water got into my lungs, and I couldn't figure out how it was supposed to work. It felt terrible, and I kept having to rise up to the surface and breathe, and the other mermaid kept saying, "No, Claire, like this," until finally I realized that she had gills in her neck, and I did too, and then it was better. Swimming was like flying. All the fish were birds. There was a boat on the surface of the ocean, and we all swam up to see the boat. It was just a little sailboat, and my mother was on it all by herself. I swam up to her, and she was surprised to see me there. She said, "Why, Claire, I thought you were getting married today." And I suddenly realized, the way you do in dreams, that I couldn't get married to Henry if I was a mermaid, and I started to cry. And then I woke up, and it was the middle of the night. So I lay there for a while in the dark, and I made up that I became a regular woman, like the Little Mermaid, except I didn't have any of that nonsense about hideous pain in my feet or getting my tongue cut out. Hans Christian Andersen must have been a very strange and sad person. Then I went back to sleep, and now I am in bed, and Henry and I are getting married today.
7:16 a.m. The ceremony is at 2 p.m., and it will take me about half an hour to dress and 25 minutes for us to drive over to St. Basil's. It is now 7:16 a.m., which leaves 5 hours and 45 minutes to kill. I throw on jeans and a skanky old flannel shirt and high tops and creep as quietly as possible downstairs seeking coffee. Dad has beat me to it. He's sitting in the breakfast room with his hands wrapped around a dainty cup of steaming black joe. I pour one for myself and sit across from him. Through the lace-curtained windows, the weak light gives Dad a ghostly look. He's a colorized version of a black-and-white movie of himself this morning. His hair is standing up every which way, and without thinking, I smooth mine down, as though he were a mirror. He does the same, and we smile.
8:17 a.m. Alicia is sitting on my bed, poking me. "Come on, Claire!" she pokes. "Daylight in the swamp, the birds are singing." Quite untrue. "And the frogs are jumping, and it's time to get up." Alicia is tickling me. She throws off the covers, and we are wrestling, and just as I pin her, Etta sticks her head in the door and hisses, "Girls, what is all this bumping? Your father, he thinks a tree fell on the house, but no, it is you sillies trying to kill each other. Breakfast is almost ready." With that, Etta abruptly withdraws her head, and we hear her barging down the stairs as we dissolve into laughter.
8:32 a.m. It's still blowing gales out there, but I am going running anyway. I study the map of South Haven, a shining jewel on the sunset coast of Lake Michigan, which Claire has provided me with. Yesterday I ran along the beach, which was pleasant but not something to do this morning. I can see 6-foot-tall waves throwing themselves at the shore. I measure out a mile of streets and figure I'll run laps. If it's too awful out there, I can cut it short. I stretch out. Every joint pops. I can almost hear tension crackling in my nerves like static in a phone line. I get dressed, and out into the world I go. The rain is a slap in the face. I am drenched immediately. I soldier slowly down Maple Street. It's just going to be a slog. I am fighting the wind, and there's no way to get up any speed. I pass a woman standing at the curb with her bulldog, and she looks at me with amazement. "This isn't mere exercise," I tell her silently. "This is desperation."
8:54 a.m. We're gathered around the breakfast table. Cold leaks in from all the windows, and I can barely see outside. It's raining so hard. How is Henry going to run in this?
"Perfect weather for a wedding," Mark jokes.
I shrug. "I didn't pick it."
"You didn't?"
"Daddy picked it."
"Well, I'm paying for it," Daddy says petulantly.
"True." I munch my toast. My mother eyes my plate critically. "Honey, why don't you have some nice bacon and some of these eggs?" The very thought turns my stomach. I can't. Really, please.
Well, at least put some peanut butter on that toast. You need protein. I make eye contact with Etta, who strides into the kitchen and comes back a minute later with a tiny crystal dish full of peanut butter. I thank her and spread some on the toast. I ask my mother, "Do I have any time before Janice shows up?" Janice is going to do something hideous to my face and hair. She's coming at 11. Why? I need to run into town to get something.
I can get it for you, sweetie.
She looks relieved at the thought of getting out of the house.
I would like to go myself.
We can both go.
By myself.
I mutely plead with her. She's puzzled but relents.
Well, okay. Goodness.
Great. I'll be right back. I get up to leave. Daddy clears his throat.
May I be excused?
Certainly.
Thank you.
I flee.
9:35 a.m. I'm standing in the immense, empty bathtub, struggling out of my cold-soaked clothes. My brand-new running shoes have acquired an entirely new shape, reminiscent of marine life. I've left a trail of water from the front door to the tub, which I hope Mrs. Blake won't mind too much. Someone knocks on my door. "Just a minute," I call. I squoosh over to the door and crack it open. To my complete surprise, it's Claire.
"What's the password?" I say softly.
"Fuck me," replies Claire. I swing the door wide. Claire walks in, sits on the bed, and starts taking off her shoes.
"You're not joking?"
"Come on, oh, almost husband mine. I've got to be back by 11. She looks me up and down.
"You went running? I didn't think you'd run in this rain."
"Desperate times call for desperate measures." I peel off my T-shirt and throw it into the tub. It lands with a splat. "Isn't it supposed to be bad luck for the groom to see the bride before the wedding?"
"So close your eyes."
Claire trots into the bathroom and grabs a towel. I lean over and she dries my hair.
"It feels wonderful. I could do with a lifetime of this, yes, indeed."
"It's really cold up here," says Claire. "Come and be bedded, almost, wife. It's the only warm spot in the whole place." We climb in.
"We do everything out of order, don't we?"
"You have a problem with that?"
"No, I like it."
"Good. You've come to the right man for all your extra-chronological needs."
11:15 a.m. I walk in the back door and leave my umbrella in the mudroom. In the hall, I almost bump into Alicia.
"Where have you been? Janice is here."
"What time is it?"
11:15. "Hey, you've got your shirt on backward and inside out."
"I think that's good luck, isn't it?"
"Maybe, but you'd better change it before you go upstairs."
I duck back into the mudroom and reverse my shirt. Then I run upstairs. Mama and Janice are standing in the hall outside my room. Janice is carrying a huge bag of cosmetics and other implements of torture.
"There you are. I was getting worried."
Mama shepherds me into my room, and Janice brings up the rear.
"I have to go talk to the caterers."
She is almost wringing her hands as she departs. I turn to Janice, who examines me critically.
"Your hair's all wet and tangled. Why don't you comb it out while I set up?"
She starts to take a million tubes and bottles from her bag and sets them on my dresser.
"Janice."
I hand her the postcard from the Uffizi. "Can you do this?" I have always loved the little Medici princess whose hair is not unlike mine. Hers has many tiny braids and pearls, all swooped together in a beautiful fall of amber hair. The anonymous artist must have loved her, too. How could he not love her?
Janice considers. "This isn't what your mom thinks we're doing."
"Uh-huh, but it's my wedding, and my hair, and I'll give you a very large tip if you do it my way."
"I won't have time to do your face if we do this. It'll take too long to do all these braids."
"Hallelujah."
"It's okay. I'll put on my own makeup."
"Well, all right. Just comb it for me and we'll get started." I begin to pick out the tangles. I'm starting to enjoy this. As I surrender to Janice's slender brown hands, I wonder what Henry is up to.
11:36 a.m.
The tux and all its attendant miseries are laid out on the bed. I'm freezing my undernourished ass off in this cold room. I throw all my cold, wet clothing out of the tub and into the sink. This bathroom is amazingly as big as the bedroom. It's carpeted and relentlessly pseudo-Victorian. The tub is an immense claw-footed thing amid various ferns and stacks of towels and a commode and a large framed reproduction of Hunt's The Awakened Conscience. The windowsill is 6 inches from the floor, and the curtains are filmy white muslin, so I can see Maple Street in all its dead leafy glory. A beige Lincoln Continental cruises lazily up the street. I run hot water into the tub, which is so large that I get tired of waiting for it to fill and climb in. I amuse myself playing with the European-style shower attachment and taking the caps off the 10 or so shampoos, shower gels, and conditioners and sniffing them all. By the 5th one, I have a headache. I sing Yellow Submarine. Everything within a 4-foot radius gets wet.
12:35 p.m. Janice releases me, and Mama and Etta converge. Etta says, "Oh, Claire, you look beautiful." Mama says, "That's not the hairstyle we agreed on, Claire." Mama gives Janice a hard time, and then pays her, and I give Janice her tip when Mama's not looking. I'm supposed to get dressed at the church, so they pack me into the car, and we drive over to St. Basil's.
12:55 p.m. Henry is 38.
I'm walking along Highway 12, about 2 miles south of South Haven. It's an unbelievably awful day, weather-wise. It's fall, rain is gusting and pouring down in sheets, and it's cold and windy. I'm wearing nothing but jeans. I'm barefoot, and I am soaked to the skin. I have no idea where I am in time. I'm headed for Meadowlark House, hoping to dry out in the reading room and maybe eat something. I have no money, but when I see the pink neon light at the cut-rate gas for less sign, I veer toward it. I enter the gas station and stand for a moment, streaming water onto the linoleum and catching my breath.
"Quite a day to be out in," says the thin, elderly gent behind the counter.
"Yep," I reply.
"Car breakdown?"
"Huh? No."
He's taking a good look at me, noting the bare feet, the unseasonable clothing. I pause, feign embarrassment.
"Girlfriend threw me out of the house." He says something, but I don't hear it because I'm looking at the South Haven Daily. Today is Saturday, October 23rd, 1993, our wedding day. The clock above the cigarette rack says 1:10.
"Gotta run," I say to the old man, and I do.
1:42 p.m. I'm standing in my 4th grade classroom, wearing my wedding dress. It's ivory watered silk with lots of lace and seed pearls. The dress is tightly fitted in the bodice and arms, but the skirt is huge, floor length with a train and 20 yards of fabric. I could hide 10 midgets under it. I feel like a parade float. But Mama is making much of me. She's fussing and taking pictures and trying to get me to put on more makeup. Alicia and Charisse and Helen and Ruth are all fluttering around in their matching sage green velvet bridesmaids' outfits. Since Charisse and Ruth are both short, and Alicia and Helen are both tall, they look like some oddly assorted Girl Scouts. But we've all agreed to be cool about it when Mama's around. They are comparing the dye jobs on their shoes and arguing about who should get to catch the bouquet. Helen says, "Charisse, you're already engaged. You shouldn't even be trying to catch it." And Charisse shrugs and says, "Insurance. With Gomez, you never know."
1:48 p.m.
I'm sitting on a radiator in a musty room full of boxes of prayer books. Gomez is pacing back and forth, smoking. He looks terrific in his tux. I feel like I'm impersonating a game show host. Gomez paces and flicks his ashes into a teacup. He's making me even more nervous than I already am.
"You got the ring?"
I ask for the gazillionth time.
"Yeah, I got the ring."
He stops pacing for a moment and looks at me.
"You want a drink?"
Yeah. Gomez produces a flask and hands it to me. I uncap it and take a swallow. It's very smooth scotch. I take another mouthful and hand it back. I can hear people laughing and talking out in the vestibule. I'm sweating and my head aches. The room is very warm. I stand up and open the window, hang my head out, breathe. It's still raining. There's a noise in the shrubbery. I open the window farther and look down. There I am, sitting in the dirt under the window, soaking wet, panting. He grins at me and gives me the thumbs up.
1:55 p.m. We're all standing in the vestibule of the church. Daddy says, "Let's get this show on the road," and knocks on the door of the room Henry is dressing in. Gomez sticks his head out and says, "Give us a minute." He throws me a look that makes my stomach clench and pulls his head in and shuts the door. I am walking toward the door when Gomez opens it again, and Henry appears, doing up his cufflinks. He's wet, dirty, and unshaven. He looks about 40. But he's here, and he gives me a triumphant smile as he walks through the doors of the church and down the aisle.